In the mid-1960s, actually it was 1965, the year I was born, there was a controversy in politics. Can you imagine? And it was the gubernatorial election in California. And Mr. Vieira will remember this. But Ronald Reagan was running for governor there. And what happened was some of the people in his party decided that they didn't want him to run. So they started dredging up all this dirt on him and started saying that he was a member of the Communist Party and he didn't belong in the party and all this. And so the chairman of the Republican Party wrote what he called the 11th Commandment. And it says, "Thou shalt not speak ill of fellow Republicans." And he stated it that way because he wanted it to be a rule that was not ignored. He wanted it followed. So he raised it to the level of one of the commandments. And for those days and for a number of elections afterwards, people actually followed that because somebody raised it up to a level of commitment that probably they wouldn't have otherwise if he had not called it the 11th commandment. Over the years, the idea of 11th commandment has been used in various ways. There's been a number of movies and books written about it over the last 100 years. And recently there was a country song that was sung by Colin Ray called The 11th Commandment. And in it he asked the question, if God had overlooked what should have been written, the 11th commandment, honor thy children. Of course, the song is talking about child abuse and how it's not talked about enough. There's not enough awareness, and there's a lot of suffering as a result. And he asked the question, if this had been a commandment, maybe we wouldn't have such a terrible blight on our society as we do with child abuse. It's a popular idea to take some issue or some cause that we might have. Celebrities take their name, their prestige, whatever they might have of that, their wealth, and they will invest in this cause or that cause, try to save this or preserve that, bring awareness to some issue that they want brought awareness to. If you could bring awareness to something that bothers you, whether it be physical, spiritual, whatever, I bet you each of us could come up with something. And I have a quick list here. Thou shalt not charge compound interest. Wouldn't it be nice for everyone trying to buy something, wouldn't especially a house, not have to be charged compound interest? Why pay $300,000 for a $100,000 house? Just seems wrong. How about thou shalt build goods to last a lifetime? No more plastic hammers. And wouldn't it be nice to know that when you buy things, you don't have to worry about them being broken and thrown in the trash the next day? My personal favorite is thou shalt make coffee taste as good as it smells when you're in the coffee aisle at the grocery store. But whether the issue you have is something in life or it is something you have in your spiritual life where you feel very strongly about something that your faith has brought you to and you've said, I feel convicted by this. This is very important. It is very easy to bring something and raise it to the level of a commandment in our lives so that you may break other problems. You may hate your brother. You may stumble on the Sabbath or even take God's name in vain or something, but you won't break this other thing. You raise it to a level where it's pretty much out of whack in your life. You know, we see this in people all the time where people will take something that's good and they'll put something that's terrible and they'll put it together. And it gives you the connotation that something's out of whack. If somebody tells you that so-and-so is an exercise nut, that person isn't in balance. They take something, exercise is good. Everybody should have exercise. But they put this word nut next to it. Now you know they're out of balance. They tell you they're a health food junkie. You say, that person probably isn't balanced. If they're a sports fanatic, spend too much time in sports. Or if they're a music freak, they spend all their time with music and they're missing other aspects of their life. The sermon today title is Beware the 11th Commandment. Because if we're not careful, we can take something that's important to us and we can raise it to a level of one of the commandments and actually create the opposite of what we're hoping for. Rather than trying to make something better in our lives, we can create a stumbling block for not only ourselves but for others. And it will impact our relationships with one another. Many of you might remember the old show from years and years ago, The Odd Couple, where you took somebody who was a ultra-neat person and somebody who was just a slob, and they put them together, and they had to live as roommates. And, of course, it was just fun and fun and fun to watch the conflict that you know would arise. And the person, Felix, who plays the neat person, he has some very good points. You shouldn't have filthy clothes on the floor. You shouldn't leave food in your bedroom, in your bed. You should bathe regularly. You should wash your clothes that you wear. And of course, the slob, Oscar, he had points too. You should be able to talk with other people without being so crazy all the time. You should be able to accept people for who they are. Relationships are important. And the two of them, if bring all those things together, could probably make a pretty nice whole person. But these two extremes together would clash. We can do this in our own lives. We can become out of balance because something is so important to us. And when somebody else that we have a relationship with, friends, brothers in the faith, are around us, it can become an issue in our lives where something is so important and somebody else doesn't feel the same way. And so then you get in a disagreement about it. And you say, oh, this is really important. And you begin sounding like Felix and Oscar. In the show, Felix would say, cleanliness is next to godliness. As if you could just wipe out all germs in your life, you and God are like this. Of course, the words cleanliness and next to godliness is not in our Bibles. To get close to God, He's more interested in our heart than the germs. It's not that there's not anecdotal evidence and even direct commands in the Bible about how to live a life without disease. It's not the most important thing. The most important thing is our relationships with one another and our relationships with God. So today we're going to talk about these things that we try to learn about and we try to keep them in perspective. And even though we get passionate about it, we want to make sure that they don't become a stumbling block for us or for others. You know, as a minister, I'm often approached by well-meaning people that say, don't you think it's wrong for so-and-so to do this? Don't you think we should have a sermon on that topic and straighten some people out? And you think, yeah, it's one approach. I personally think that the best way to reach somebody is through example. And that doesn't mean that there should not be instruction, and not even doesn't mean there shouldn't be correction from the pulpit from time to time. But it's interesting how we, each of us, are so invested in our own growth path. God has called each of us from different areas of our lives, different areas of the world, and we each have a different growth path, and each of us have things that we have to learn that somebody else may not have to learn. You think about a special school where some kids are focused on mathematics because that's their weakness. And other kids are brought into reading because that's their weakness. And other kids might be brought into another discipline, history or whatever it is. And they're given targeted education based upon their needs. You know, if you're not careful, when you come out of a system like that, you might think everybody needs to learn math because that's all I learned in school. And you didn't spend any time on math. So you're out of balance because we get a perspective from what we're taught. If God teaches us certain lessons as we come into the church and we stumble and stumble, maybe we stumble over tithing, maybe we stumble over working on the Sabbath, maybe we stumble over inappropriate different activities in our lives, and then we overcome that, then we become a champion for that. And then when we see somebody else that we see is out of whack, we feel, wow, I need to straighten that person out. And then you have a conflict. You know, God works with each of us, but the one thing that I notice is He is so patient with us. He gives us so much time to spend growing and overcoming what we have, and we make mistakes each and every day. And it's amazing how forgiving we can be of ourselves when we make a mistake. We might feel terrible and we come to God and we ask for forgiveness. And then we feel God has forgiven us. And for us, that is gone. We're on to something else. And yet it's easy to hold a grudge against somebody else that has a different problem. Maybe one that we've overcome. Or maybe they have an understanding that is different than ours. And we think, their understanding is wrong. And now it just bothers me. Turn to 2 Corinthians 3. Paul is talking to the church in Corinth here. And he has some imagery that I think goes to the heart of what we're trying to talk about today. He's commending the people of Corinth here. And listen to the words that he chose to use to commend these people. In 2 Corinthians 3, verses 2 and 3, "You are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read by all men. Clearly, you are an epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh, that is, of the heart." Is there any doubt what he's referring to when he says tablets of stone? This is a world that these people were coming out of, where the tablets of stone, things that were written down for their ancestors, were very, very important. And I know Mr. Walker's covering covenants, and this is one of those things that Paul was witnessing, how people came from one covenant into another, and they were melded together with Gentiles and Christians that were made from the Jewish faith and from the Gentile faith, and they're merging together and becoming one congregation, obviously from very different backgrounds, different viewpoints. What should you do on circumcision? What should you do on the very Jewish holidays versus what we would see as the holidays that all Christians keep of that day, like the main holy days? And so he was commending them, and he was saying, we're not writing on tablets of stone, we're writing on your heart. You compare that to what Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 17:1, and he also has this idea of writing on tablets. And it has a very similar theme is what Paul was saying. But he is saying it in a way to say that they didn't get it. He says in Jeremiah 17 and verse 1, "The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron, which the point of a diamond, it is engraved on the tablet of their heart and the thorns of your altars." Why would you have to write something with a diamond? Diamond being the hardest thing that we have, because their heart has turned hard. Their heart has turned into like a tablet of stone. They didn't get it. All the time that God tried to work with Israel, then splitting into two kingdoms, and worked with each of them so that they would have a heart to follow God. And they just didn't get it. And so their heart hardened. And he says, that's what we needed. We need to write this on your heart so it's actually there. You know, Christ was confronted many times on different things that were traditions of men, that were ways of life that they accepted for many, many generations. Many of our older members here might remember 11th commandments that we've had around here. Things like not eating white bread. 11th commandment, do not eat processed sugar. If you're going to have a car, make sure it's a plain one. I mean, these are things that in the church years ago, well-meaning people said, you know what? If you're going to be the right kind of person, humble and contrite, these are the ways you should dress. This is the way you should act. These are the things you should say. This is what you should eat. And it isn't, in many ways, much different than what was going on in Christ's time, where Pharisees were telling people how to act and how to be. And you think, well, no, it's not the same because the Pharisees were terrible. And you're right. Some of them were. Some of them were concerned about power. Some of them were concerned about their influence over the people and maintaining control. But when Christ talked to them, sometimes you could tell. Some of the things he said were quite biting. Some of the things he said were quite condemning of the Pharisees. But other times, the things that he said to the Pharisees were to try to teach them. Because in amongst the leadership cast of that day, you had a whole gamut of people. Some actually were concerned about keeping to the letter of the law because it was the way that God would be pleased with them. If you look back at the history of ancient Israel, it's this story of Israel turning their back on God time and time again, throwing away God's laws, throwing away his covenant, just going off and lusting after the things in this world that God says will not bring you love, will not bring you happiness, will not bring you life. And when they reestablished under Nehemiah the temple and the Jerusalem was rebuilt, they worked really hard to try to make a society that followed God without question. And so one of the things that they did is unlike what we did back years ago in the church, where we say, you know, if you're going to keep the Sabbath, these are the kinds of things you should do. And if you're going to be a good person in business, this is the kinds of business stuff you should do. They wrote these things called fence laws to prevent people from sinning because it was the best way to model the behavior of the people, because if you just left it up to them, anything goes. If you said it's up to you how you keep these commandments, everyone's going to interpret them differently. And what happened before is, next thing you know, you had chaos and people were running around doing all sorts of terrible, nasty things, and God took them all into captivity. So they worked really hard to try to model behavior so that maybe God would bless them and they could be made a kingdom once again, have their own king, have their own, throw off the weight of the Romans that had ruled them for so long. And so some of them were well-meaning. One of the first times that Christ was challenged over the Sabbath was in Matthew 12. Matthew 12. He'd been challenged on other things, but the first confrontation he had over the Sabbath, we can read here in Matthew 12, starting in verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read when David was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only the priest?" Now you might think, that's his defense? Yeah, what the disciples are doing is wrong, but what David did was wrong. Was that his defense? Was he given a defense that, yeah, that might be wrong, but we're no wronger than what David did? It is an interesting exchange. He's not condemning those that asked him about the Sabbath. He's giving a lesson, and what would not have fallen on deaf ears to those who he's talking to is when David ate the showbread, he didn't just have this minor infraction where he's at a meal and somebody fed him some bread and they said, "Oh, you didn't know that was showbread." David knew exactly what he was doing. David was being hunted by the king, Saul. And you can read about this later if you want to read through 1 Samuel 21. And so he goes to the temple and he sees the priest and he lies to him. And says, "We're on a mission for the king. And we're hungry and we need to eat." And left in so so much haste, we didn't even have time to get weapons. We just don't have the provisions we need. He ends up getting the sword of Goliath. And he talks him into getting the showbread. And the story goes, well, you know, you're about to change the showbread out anyway. And when you do that, you're about to put all new showbread out. And so we'll take the stuff that you're going to pull off, the day-old stuff. And the priest's like, I don't see anything wrong with that. You're on a mission from the king. And some of the commentaries I read talked about, well, you know, this was done around the time of the Sabbath, where they changed the showbread out. So the example that Christ was using might have very well been, you know, we ate grain on the Sabbath. David's men ate the showbread from the temple on the Sabbath. And the other thing that would not have missed the hearer of this story is the fact that when you read, you're waiting for the part where the hammer comes down on David for eating the showbread. Where was the part he got punished? Where was the part that was brought out, how dare you? Christ admits he did what was not lawful. But they know he never got punished for it. So what are they thinking? What are they to think that Christ used an example of something that was done on the Sabbath that clearly wasn't lawful as his main defense for the fact that these disciples were out there pulling grain? Now, some commentaries talk about, well, Jesus could have made the argument about gleaning, and gleaning was legal to do. And this really wasn't harvesting, as they were trying to claim. But Christ was teaching here. This wasn't trying to get out of trouble. He was actually trying to bring them to an understanding about a way of life that was missing to them. And there's a lot more that we're going to read here. So in verse 5 it says, or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? And we know what the priests did. They're slaughtering these animals. It's a lot of physical work. The work to run the temple on Sabbath and holy days is a huge burden. So if you were to write things down that says this is considered work and this is not considered work, there's no way you could not know what the priests were doing would be under the heading of this is hard work. This is physical hard work. But they said, well, yeah, there's an exception for priests. So, yeah, we know that they do, they profane the Sabbath, but they're blameless because they're doing the work of God. And then Jesus makes an argument to end all arguments when he says, yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. So, if you're thinking what David did in the temple was bad, it was an infraction of the law, and if you're thinking about what the priests do in the temple as possibly sketchy because it's on a technicality, he's saying, there's somebody here in your midst that's greater than the temple. I mean, this should trump your arguments that you might have about what is and what isn't okay. And then he says, but if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. So, how does he go from talking about, well, yeah, there was infractions, but there's somebody here greater than the temple. And if you had known what this phrase meant, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. And then he says, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. So you can say, well, here he's pulling rank. God can do that. God can say whatever he wants. But there's a point to be made here. And I think Jesus was taking time to teach them something. This phrase, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. When you read through the passages here, there's three places that is mentioned that this is given. And the first time we read Christ using these words, it's back in Matthew 9. And it's talking about, this is back when Jesus is sitting down with tax collectors and people are saying, you're associating with the wrong people. This isn't how you conduct your life. We have rules about who you associate with. And he uses this phrase in Matthew 9, verse 13. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. He tells them, go figure out what this phrase means. It's not the first time that they've heard that phrase. And when he says it later in Matthew 12, he is again challenging them about this phrase. If you had known what this phrase means, you wouldn't have blamed the guiltless. Well, this phrase is found a number of places in the Old Testament. It's found in 1 Samuel 15, 22. It's found in Hosea 6, verse 6 and 7. And Micah 6, chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. Each of these are talking about the relationship of God with his people and how they conduct themselves and how they adhere to what God is trying to teach them. See, if they get themselves out of whack, the Old Covenant had it set up, so if you got yourself out of whack, there was a process to get yourself back in to God's graces. There was a series of sacrifices and offerings that you could do, and it straightens you out. And Jesus is using this as a teachable moment to say there's something you guys are missing through all this. Let's go back and read Micah. Micah 6. And starting in verse 6. Before I do, I'd like to just read a little bit of a commentary here from Expositor's Bible Commentary talking about Micah. Oh, excuse me. We're not going to read Micah. We're going to read Hosea 6. I've got it marked in my Bible. We're going to read Hosea 6 in verse 6. But you can certainly go through Micah 6 and read the context, and you will see it's very similar to what we're reading here. So this is what Expositor's Bible Commentary says about the book of Hosea. He says, the central thought of Hosea concerns God's covenant with Israel that the people had and people had broken. The covenant had been made at Mount Sinai in the wilderness, and at which time God found the people like grapes in the desert and early fruit on the fig tree. God loved the people and called them his son. Through the passing years, however, they wandered away from God and more called after other gods. The further they went away from him, the deeper they fell into sin, breaking the covenant so graciously made with them. And it goes on and on talking about how Hosea spends a lot of time talking about the covenant that they were breaking, that the laws that they were breaking, but more than that, he talked about how the fact that the people drifted from God and how God was lamenting at the relationship that was gone. Hosea was a prophet in the north. They were about to be overrun in this period of time. At the beginning of Hosea's reign, Israel was doing really well, the northern kingdom. Spiritually, they were terrible. But under Jeroboam II, they had expanded their borders to what it was way back in the early kingdom days. They had established their borders and had quite a section of land that they held, great expanse. And you might think, wow, things are going great. You think about the United States in the 1950s and 60s, where we were sort of at the height of our power. You think, well, that country's got it all together. They're really blessed. And how close the United States has come in just the last 30 or 40 years. How fast the fall. It's like this in Hosea's time. The people weren't wonderful at the beginning of Hosea's mission, but you could look at them on the outward and say, they must be doing pretty well. And then the end comes, and everything comes crashing down. So let's read in Hosea 6, verses 4 through 6, where we find this phrase that Christ references. O Ephraim, what shall I do to you? O Judah, what shall I do to you? For your faithfulness is like the morning cloud, like the early dew that goes away. I was talking in Roseburg this morning, and when we started services, it was foggy. is a really thick fog. And as we were driving, even though I'd been there before, I had to kind of slow down at different streets and say, is this the street? Is this the street? You can't recognize where you are. The fog was so thick. And by the time I got to this part in the sermon, it was beautiful sunny outside. You would know there was no sign that there was ever a cloud. And this is what God is saying here. Like the morning clouds, it just drifts away. This is their faithfulness to God. Therefore, I have hewn them by the prophets. I have slain them by my words of my mouth. And your judgments are like light that goes forth. For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. What does this mean? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. This word mercy is translated a number of different ways. Love, compassion, steadfastness. The Revised Standard says of Hosea 6:6, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice. What God wants isn't them to always remember to wash their hands when they're supposed to, and always remember that when you make a mistake, okay, where's your burnt offering? You've got to do these things in this order or else you're not right with God. That is not what God wanted from them. It's not that he didn't tell them to do those things. What he wanted was their heart. What the things that God had them do was supposed to teach them was how to give their heart to him. And they weren't able to do it. I would rather have you have knowledge of me, he says, than your burnt offerings. I would rather have you dedicated to my way of life than your strict adherence to every little thing. It's not that he's saying, I don't want you to adhere to everything. But if you're going to choose, he wants your heart. God wants our heart, and he wants a relationship with us. And it's very easy for us to get ourselves in kind of a bad place. Proverbs 3:5 tells us, trust in the Lord with all your heart, but lean not on your own understanding. And we feel like, you know, God is working with me, and therefore I understand this. So this is truth for me. And it may be truth. It may actually be what you have stumbled across, what you have found, might be exactly right on. But your neighbor might not have come to that yet. And you might be leaning on your own understanding. You know, Romans 14:1 says, receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to dispute over doubtful things. And what's interesting about this, if you both agree that it's doubtful, why are you disputing? Usually one of the two parties is pretty sure that it's not doubtful. It's doubtful for one of you. And Paul is warning, don't get in disputes over those things. No matter how much something is important to you, until God brings all of us around. And remember, if you think the things that we do are the most important to God, then maybe spend some time and read through Romans 14. We get down to verse 4. Let's read Romans 14. Let's go down. This whole section in Romans 14 is talking about things that divide the congregation. And he lists some examples, things that they eat, the ways that they worship. And you can do a long study and say, what kind of things are we talking about here? But whether these things can be directly compared to your life or not, the principle that is given here is applicable to all of us. And what he says here in Romans 14 and verse 4, who are you to judge another's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. Each of us are accountable to God. So if we run into a disagreement with one another, if we start trying to condemn one another or straighten one another out, we're trying to straighten out someone else's servant. They're God's servants. And God says it's his responsibility to straighten somebody out. And this, you know, when you think about how many splits there have been in the church for however many years, you know, at some point when somebody's at the feast and there's three of them, maybe they'll say, maybe we have parsed the word a little too much. Maybe we have worried about the jots and the tittles more than the heart. Because what God wants is our heart. And he wants a merciful heart. He is merciful to us. When you study ancient Israel, what you'll find is, if it was all about obedience, Israel would have been in the doghouse all the time. But Israel spent 7 years without captivity for every year that they spent in captivity. And they deserve just the opposite. They deserve probably 19 years of captivity for every 1 year they were free, based on their adherence to the law. But God gave them time, and he was patient, and he allowed bad things to exist in the congregation in hopes that their heart would turn to him. So that's the example that we should have. So if you have things in your life that are important to you, it's good to have them. Things that will make you healthier or wiser or smarter or better financier or even a better Christian. And those are wonderful things, as long as you keep them in balance. But let's not raise them to the level of a commandment, to where it becomes a stumbling block for those around us. If you do, though, have to have an 11th commandment, if you do happen to just say, I got to have one more, 10 are good, but I got to have an 11th, there's no better one that you can pick than John 13, verses 34 and 35. John 13, verses 34 and 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.